This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And world events, they unfold in real time. Now you can trade them with IBKR Prediction Markets. Trade elections, climate, and economic outcomes alongside stocks, options, and bonds, all in one integrated platform. These are simple yes or no contracts priced to reflect the market's view of probability. If your prediction is right, you'll receive $1 per contract and earn interest on your position while you're invested. IBKR Prediction Markets turn market expectations into actionable trades. Prediction contracts, of course, are not suitable for all investors. Learn more at ibkr.com/predictions.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
We have a new ceasefire and a 60-day extension. PCE numbers are out and inflation somehow is cooling. Hard to believe. More government handouts, and the stocks are rallying on that news. And our guest this week is Wes Gray, founder of Alpha Architect. Great guest coming on. All this and much more on episode number 975 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And welcome to the Summertime Markets here on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Horowitz, and thanks for joining me this week and every week to talk about your finances, your money, your investments, and how, in fact, we're going to get you, that's right, towards financial security, financial freedom, that mecca of the mountain where money is not going to be haunting you every night because we're going to be doing the right things. We're going to be working on discipline. We're going to be working on understanding of what it means to actually invest in a way that's going to get you towards that level. And that's what we do here every single week. I mean, we bring in some great guests, but we have great conversations too. Starting the show off this week, we're going to talk about what's going on right now in the markets, touch on a little bit of economics, and try to make some heads or tails about what is happening. Because a lot of people, I think, are pretty concerned about what's going on right now. The fact of the matter is that it's confusing. It's difficult. It's hard to understand a lot of the reasons why markets are going up, but yet we see all this bad news. It's the summertime. Summertime markets are often kind of boring. You've heard the old adage, sell in May and go away. Well, here we are in May, and I guess the go away is about to start in just a couple of days. We're about to enter into June, July, August. The old idea was a lot of the traders would go away. They'd go on vacation. They'd find somewhere to hide away, get away from the desk. And what that would mean was that they weren't trading. But these days, we're trading, right? You could just simply run an entire book of business right on your phone. And the fact of the matter is that it's handy, it's there, the information is available, the apps are great, and that is creating a situation where it makes it very easy for traders to stay, maybe not on the desk, but in touch with what is going on. Nothing boring about what is going on right now in the markets. I got to tell you that right now. Day to day, there's action. And if there's no action, somebody's going to come on with some kind of news and like, hey, here's my shot. I'm going to create some kind of really interesting news item right now. There's plenty of warnings too. We've seen that there's a lot of people that are coming out on the various news lines, on TV, even on podcasts, on radio. And they're saying, you know what? We don't trust this. One of the big things that's going on is maybe the SpaceX IPO is going to suck the guts, the wind, to take everything out of the markets. When it happens, when we're talking about a $1.75 trillion mammoth investment, and that, in fact, is going to cause a lot of disruption. Mark my word, it's going to cause disruption. It may not be permanent, but when it comes out, when this IPO actually comes out, the disruption is going to be real, because what's going to happen is we're going to have a situation where a lot of the index funds that are going to get this inclusion of this gigantic stock, which usually wouldn't happen so fast, they'd have time. But the inclusion of SpaceX into the S&P, and as more importantly, the NASDAQ 100 almost immediately within a few days is going to cause all those index buyers to buy it up very quickly, creating a bit of a floor under the stock. And that's good because there's a lot shorter period in which the lockup period expires on this deal. It's going to be a bit of a rolling lockup period on this one, but a lot shorter for some of them where they can employees can get rid of their shares. So that's a lot about what's going on in the next few months and a lot of anticipation. There's also a lot of money that's still being spent, whether it's from stimulus that's left over from the Biden era or even what's going on with OBA through Trump. There's still stimulus in the system. And then when there's not stimulus, we got governments doing things like talking about reducing rates in some areas, like in Korea, they may do it. Stock market's up, economy's on fire, but they're still talking about reducing rates. Here in the United States, we have Kevin Warsh recently put into position at the Fed as the chair. We'll see. Bets are that he's going to actually increase rates. We'll see. The fact of the matter is that right now, government is also playing a healthy hand in the helping hand business. They're buying up positions in drone companies and buying up positions in quantum companies. We don't even have a sovereign wealth fund here in the United States. They're just going ahead and taking positions and pieces of these companies while giving them money. That is creating a big buzz and a significant safety net, if you will, or maybe even an underhanded way of profiting on some of this for our benefit, for the taxpayers' benefit. That's great, but it's not the usual course of business. But it's interesting. It's not boring. It's not your usual summertime boredom that happens with markets just kind of just hanging in there, nothing happening, maybe some selling off. Markets are still loving the fact that there is this massive amount of money that's being really pushed in on a regular basis, whether it's from the government or from stimulus or from some other places like capital spending, CapEx spending. We're not going to go too deeply into that this week. We have a great guest coming on next week. He is the chief market analyst of Interactive Brokers, and I'm pretty excited that he's going to be joining us. First time having him on the show, and he's a great name and a great resource. I do want to talk about some of the economics very quickly, just buzz through these that we saw this week because I think they were important. We saw the second quarter estimate of GDP. Okay, fine. Revised a little bit lower, 1.6% from about 2% expected. I don't think there's a lot going on there. We may see it revised up again when the third and final estimate comes out. So that's something to think about. The GDP deflator came out of 3.5% below expectations. Maybe some easing of inflation pressures, but I'll kind of move down the list and talk about PCE, the Fed's preferred inflation gauge. personal consumption expenditures up 0.4%, slightly below expectations, still hot. The core up 0.2. We're looking at, if you multiply that by 12, looking at an annualized basis, up 2.4%. So that's, again, excluding food and energy, which we can't do. Personal income was flat. No increase in personal income, below expectations. I'd consider that maybe a softer read. Personal spending, solid plus 5. People are still spending. So even though all the inflation numbers we looked at, the fact that things are more expensive, the reality is that right now, when we look at what's really gone on, the fact that consumer sentiment is moving down doesn't seem to bother anybody. I feel miserable. I'm going to spend money. Maybe that's what's going on. Maybe it's like, I feel miserable. I'm going to eat. Maybe that was the old way. I'm going to give me some ice cream. Give me some candy. Give me a steak. I got to eat something. I'm so miserable. Maybe what's happening now is not that. Maybe what's happening now is like, you know what? I'm going to buy something for myself. I'm going to go on a vacation. I'm going to travel. I'm feeling miserable. Oh man, I got to do this. I'm going to buy something. Let's go. Let's get on Amazon. Buy one of the specials or something like that. But it's happening. So overall, inflation readings are better than expected. That did help out towards the end of the week a little bit. Now, in terms of business investment, durable goods orders, we saw those numbers come out. Strong headline number, up 7.9% during the month. Transportation was a big one. Of course, some of the flow from Boeing and the planes that were being bought. Core durable goods were up 1.1%, excluding transportation. So about a 6% swing there on that number. Labor markets and digital jobless claims came out late in the week on Thursday, 215,000 steady as can be. Continuing claims, again, steady and stable. So growth was revised a little bit lower overall, not significantly at all to speak of. Inflation continues to be sticky, problematic, but there's a moderation that's going on there. Encouraging overall, I believe, is what we have to say about that. And at the same time, consumers, spending, resilient. Don't count them out. Do not count out the American consumer. Maybe it's because they feel so horrible. So that's something to be thought about. This is not only the consumer spending, but businesses are spending. CapEx is up dramatically. We saw huge numbers last week. We saw something from, we saw that Amazon's getting a big piece and Snowflake is spending and billion here and billion there. And IBM is going to be $2 billion commitment towards their quantum programs. And we're not talking about little bits of money here. And a lot of this sneaks in to the market somehow, whether it's through increase in labor to get to the point where it is, whether it's an increase in need for more bandwidth, cloud, compute, whatever it is, construction, all seems to sneak in. So lots going on there. So I think that kind of interesting of what we saw there. I would say that if I was to encapsulate the two parts of what we saw last week with the numbers coming out with companies and economics, pretty much the same as what we've been seeing. And that's why there is this underside, this relative bullish trend that continues. Even in the sight of this whole farce that we have a ceasefire, but yet we're lobbing bombs on them, that, you know, we believe it's a breach in the ceasefire when Iran throws out a ballistic missile to Kuwait. Well, that's terrible. That's a ceasefire breach, but we don't do anything about it. What we do is we give a 60-day extension of the actual talks that are going absolutely nowhere, let's be honest. Last weekend, what was the big news that rallied the markets initially on Monday? It was over the weekend that we had an imminent deal that was on the table. 2 days later, not such a rush to do anything. There is knowledge in Washington that climbing the world wall of worry is good for the stocks. There's an understanding that we go this way a little bit, this way. And every time we say something good, the markets go up. Every time bad, nobody cares. There's an understanding about that. Mark my word. Trust me on this. You can see it plain as day, and they are playing it like a fiddle. Something to think about. Now, lots of you took advantage of something. We had that book giveaway, the signed book giveaway for the Disciplined Investor, and lots of you took advantage of that. What we said was, any new clients to come in, send us your portfolio. Let's review it. If you like what we say, maybe we'll work with you. You liked it. We sent you the books. And there was kind of such a nice response. I figured, well, maybe into the summer we'll do it again. I was thinking about it. I don't know. Should I? I'm kind of a softie, so I guess we'll do it again. So if you want us to review your portfolio, just let me know. Go to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Drop me a note over on the contact us there or ask Andrew and say, hey, listen, how do I get this to you through a secure server? And we'll just hook you up right away and show you how to do it. Maybe something we can help you with. Maybe not. Maybe everything is great. Maybe you've done a great job. Maybe everything is perfect with what you did. I'll tell you that too. Plenty of times we're like, you know what? You have what you need. You're aligned. Don't do anything. But a lot of times I got to tell you, people like into the next phase of where we're going right now, am I in the right position? I'm like, well, you don't have these couple of components that could really help your diversification. Or you know what? You're telling me you're aggressive and you have the most conservative portfolio sitting all in cash. You can't move it on your own probably. Let us help you with it. Let's go through our dollar cost averaging multi-pronged approach with one foot in, one foot out. Let's help you with the systematic time-based, and let's help you with the opportunistic side of our dollar cost averaging. I don't know. Anyway, we'll do it again for June. That's the point. Go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and click on the Ask Andrew. We'll send you a copy of The Disciplined Investor, the actual copy of the book, not a PDF, signed by me, wishing you the best, and we'll get it going for you. Now we're going to get to our guest. So let's get moving with that, shall we? A quick note before I introduce you to Wes Gray, let's talk about Interactive Brokers. And you know, I've said this before, but you're diligent. You research your investments, you analyze the markets, but have you researched your broker? For the past 3 years, Interactive Brokers individual clients average, get this, 24.3% annual return, beating the S&P 500. Lower costs, competitive rates, and access to over 170 global markets helped investors keep more of what they earn. You know, the broker that you choose matters. Interactive Brokers, member SIPC. Learn more at ibkr.com/performance. That's ibkr.com/performance. Let me take a minute and let's talk about Wes Gray, because this is a really interesting guy. I mean, really interesting guy. Because he was a captain in the United States Marine Corps, and then he earned an MBA and a PhD in finance from the University of Chicago, where he studied under Nobel Prize winner Eugene Fama. That's pretty impressive. Next, he took on an academic job in his hometown, in his wife's hometown of Philadelphia, worked as a finance professor at Drexel. Now, his interest in bridging the research gap between academia and industry led him to be founder of what is known as Alpha Architect. This is an asset management firm and is dedicated to an impact mission of empowering investors through education. He's been seen in so many different industry publications, published multiple times in academic papers, written several books. This is the real deal. Let's get it on with him. And Wes Gray, back from South America. How are you?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. A lot of things I want to talk to you about. We've talked before, of course. And, you know, you studied, I'm always so impressed by this. It's kind of like a little bit of a fanboy, because you studied under Eugene Fama at Chicago Booth, right?
I did.
And yep. that must have been pretty cool.
It was very cool. It's great getting hazed by a Nobel Prize winner. Every day.
Every day. I can imagine. So you transitioned through that period from fundamental value picking, right, to systematic quant approach. And kind of, I guess there's some of that, you know, obviously what he taught, and a lot of what he taught was a very big influence on you. But What I want to know is, what specific evidence or maybe even experiences convinced you that more of a rules-based quant process is going to outperform discretionary stock picking for capturing value and momentum premiums?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess it kind of goes back through my life as an investor. So just the quick recap. It's funny because I kind of see parallels, unfortunately, in deja vu in many respects in our current market. But basically what happened is I kind of got started in like 99 is when I got really into like investing and stock picking. And I was just lucky because I'd gotten introduced to like the whole Warren Buffett value investing thing in the midst of when, if you recall, that was like when the NASDAQ triple Q was also insane. And like, you know, anything with a .com on the end of it would just go up 100%, kind of like AI today, right? It's like, right. I see like there's a lot of parallels. And so I got lucky in a sense that at the very peak of that, I was just like, well, why would you do that? You should buy these like cheap value stocks. And just by dumb luck, you know, I was a stock picker at the time, you know, in 2020, all the go-go stocks went down 90%. I was making money. And then there was this massive small cap value run for the next, you know, 10 or 15 years. And so obviously, you know, through that whole period, there's a lot of things I did, but I was doing great. And I thought it was because I was awesome.
You are,
at picking stocks.
You're the best.
Yeah, I'm the best, right? Like, look at the market. It's just reinforcing how smart I am. And then, of course, you know, this story doesn't end well, obviously. But through like I got into the PhD program. I started in 2002. I started getting influenced, obviously, by Fama and all the quants and all this other research out there. I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting. They're basically saying that computers can essentially replicate, you know, what I'm doing. And there's no way, because I'm way smarter than that. But long story short, I ended up for my dissertation studying this organization called Value Investors Club, which I don't know if you're familiar with. It's all these hedge fund managers and stock pickers. They basically submit their stock picks to this message board that's kind of like exclusive access only. Mm-hmm. And at the time, I don't know how big it is now, but there was 4,000 stock pitches. And so I literally cataloged every single one, you know, did all the research on it, cranked the numbers. I'm like, holy cow, these guys beat the market.
Yeah.
Which was kind of cool because my original intent was like, hey, can we prove to FAMA that like the market's not efficient, that stock pickers can actually make money? And that's basically what I essentially showed. But then the more interesting thing is that had you just done small cap value at that time, like if you just had a computer pick like, you know, small stocks that are like cheap priced with high quality, it would have basically had the same performance, if not better. Mm. Than what I had been doing stock picking the whole time, right? Because I was doing that analysis as well. And then so it kind of got in my head. I'm like, wait a second. Maybe all these quant researchers are right because, you know, I've been living through the stress and the emotional, you know, pain of stock picking. And I could use this damn computer and basically get to the same output, but with way less brain damage. Duh. I should probably do that, right? So it's just, for me, it was like it took me a long time to get there, probably about 15 years in total. But you know, eventually it happens to everybody.
So,
but just
when did, I don't know if you know this, but
yeah,
I remember small cap value. If you look at that mm-hmm. and you look at it just on a basis of, that factor, right? Small cap value only, if I'm not mm-hmm. mistaken, one of the early, this guy came up in conversation this week too. Jim O'Shaughnessy mm-hmm. wrote a book called What Works on Wall Street back when. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong about this, but in the end of this giant book, right, it was like, just go small cap value and just throw everything else out. It was like, that was the winner. That was the one. And if I'm not mistaken, that's what happened there.
Yes, pretty much. And to your point, Jim's book's like 1,000 pages. And I got multiple copies of it. It's a great book. And I think he was basically small cap value. I think he had some momentum in there too. I can't recall exactly. But yes, that was the punchline. And it just so happened that the best run in recent memory of that strategy was from like 2000 to essentially 2008. Since then, as everyone knows, the last 10 years, it's been a dirt ball because obviously buying S&P was the best idea on the planet Earth. That's decidedly not small cap value. I mean, the rest of this, you know, story is still to be told. You know, we got to live for another 20, 30 years out of sample. But, you know, markets change and markets evolve. But that was, to answer your question, that's how I switched from being a stock picker, you know, to being just more quant based, is I kind of realized that the computers can do most of the work just as well. And that the market's really good about giving you a big ego, usually exactly at the wrong time, when you shouldn't have an ego. Right. And that's just the nature of it. And, you know,
you touched on 1999. I was there. It's funny because before that, value was really in good shape. As a matter of fact, there was a big, there was a really big, I guess, competition, controversy. It was, you know, this, who's mm-hmm. better? Was it Alliance at the time, before they were Alliance Bernstein? Was Alliance, which was a growth shop, or Bernstein, which was a value shop? And I can tell you, and actually, I'm going to throw one more in there. Northern Trust was really the one that was the key. They were a growth shop back then. They were like, you know, Northern Trust guys were like, these guys would be driving their Porsches, their Maseratis, all that down the street, you know, during the time when growth was doing well. The Bernstein guys were still, you know, in the tight collared suits, you know, red tie, blue, you know, the IBM look kind of thing, right? That was the Bernstein.
Yeah.
And there was a time back then, if I don't know if you remember this, but they're flipping, right? And everybody was running into the private wealth management of Bernstein for a while when value was doing well prior to, I guess, maybe 1995, 6, 7, through there, right? Mm-hmm. And then everybody flipped when it didn't do well and they lost all sorts of money. They flipped into growth, thinking into Northern Trust when they were thinking they were kings of it all. And then that went down the tubes too. And then they had no idea what to do.
Yes, I agree. I remember specifically being in Janus 20
Fund. Oh gosh,
which is like the Kathy Wood
of the day
equivalent. It feels like,
right?
If you remember that one,
I do remember.
That was actually my first mutual fund. by dumb luck, my dad's like, hey, you should buy this Janus 20 guy because some broker sold it to me.
Yep.
And it was crazy. I mean, it ended up losing all of its money. And I think they probably went out of business. But at the time, it was awesome.
It was hot. It was like the Nifty 50, but the 20 concentration.
Yeah.
You know, and that's another question I have about concentration. You know, your ETFs that you concentrate, right? And you're about less than...
In our factory ETFs, yeah, yes. Factory like ETFs. We do 50 stock plus or minus in those.
So they're equity weighted, industry constraint issues. You know, what level of this concentration or why this level, I guess, of the concentration mm-hmm. versus broader factor tilts?
Sure. So the reason for that is, you know, we were never in the industry. Ever. I was a PhD and then I was a professor in finance and I was just trying to deal with my own money and I didn't know how the industry worked, which I guess was a blessing at the time. But the whole idea is like in academic research, when you do that research, just generically speaking, even Ben Graham used to do this. Hey, let's just go take 1,000 stocks, sort them on PE ratio. And what happens if you buy the 10% cheapest? Oh, wow. They outperform. That's called the value effect. And so intuitively, because that's how it's researched, that's how the evidence is documented, I was like, well, that's how you would build the portfolio. Right. And, you know, because that's just, I didn't know how the industry worked. And of course, what you learn in the industry is, no, you would never do that because that creates this thing called tracking error, i.e. you start deviating in extreme ways from the index. You know, so I know that now, but at the time, like I was just trying to make money and build portfolios just based on like what the actual evidence says and like sure. how they're constructed.
Right.
So that's why we did that. And that's why we've always done that. And we just tell people like, listen, this is not like every other portfolio where it starts off with S&P 500 and then adds a basis point, takes a basis point away, and then charges you a bunch of money to basically give you what Vanguard gives you for free.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, that's basically why we concentrate is because, sure. you know, why would you just do what everyone else does? That doesn't make any sense.
So,
if you're going to do that, but just how do you go manage, buy a Vanguard.
How do you manage liquidity with that and mm-hmm. turnover capacity? Because I mean, obviously if it's market cap weighted, then there's plenty of volume, plenty of, but you start getting to some of the other factors, mm-hmm. even if it is market weighted, but market cap weighted, it still can be smaller and there can be volume issues. And if you grow that thing big enough, right?
Yeah. So 100%. So we run those things in the ETF wrapper. And I think, you know, I'm not going to name the tickers because then I'll have some compliance problem, I'm sure. But, you know, generic like value strategies, maybe all of our factor funds have like $1 billion or $1.5 billion in those specific funds. And I mean that, if they got to like 10 billion or 20 billion, we'd have to start doing more liquidity bucketing and what have you.
Right.
But, and obviously if we got hundreds of billions of dollars, then we, like everyone else, would be forced to basically closed index mm-hmm. because if you have a lot of capital, you become the market. Yes.
I mean, that's a funny thing you mentioned then. That's a really good point though, because where does that demarcation point come to? It's like, hey, we're growing and you got partners and you got people and you got staff and you got, you know, everybody's like, well, just keep it going. And then you're like, well, then you're no differentiation from anybody else.
Yeah. So there's a bunch of academic papers that have talked about this you see it in the data and it makes sense. Right. Mm-hmm. And I'll explain how we're a little bit different as a firm, but essentially what happened is asset management in the end is massive fixed cost. And then it's all about scale.
Right.
Right. And so once you get to a point where you're like, oh, I can raise money and now we're just like a distribution marketing organization, you might lose instead of like trying to actually do research, trying to beat the market, trying to do unique things, you might say, hey, let's just pretend like we're doing that. Right. And let's just distribute it. Cause no one got fired for hiring Goldman Sachs.
Sure.
For example, like we have like under our whole umbrella, we're probably like almost $40 billion now. And so, you know, you could do that. And so that's usually the strong incentive is like, okay, we need to pivot away from these weirdo boutique, non-scalable turd strategies and like just do closet indexing and market it like it's some fancy thing because that's what's in our economic incentive. Right. So that's what most people do. And you see that in the data. We took a different approach in the sense that the way we monetized kind of all our fixed costs and brain damage is we started an infrastructure firm. where we now, we do what they call ETF white labeling. So we still have our ETFs, but instead of having the pressure to just, you know, scale and sell those things and like anyone with a pulse, like, please buy this, you know, because that's just not the nature of how we've ever operated. But we had all this excess capacity on the fixed cost to launch ETFs. So what we did is we just basically monetized that, and we have other people that use our platform where we basically do all the work, and they launch ETFs on our platform, but it's their brand. They go distribute, et cetera. And so that works out, because now
taking care of the wrapper, the process, yep. the advisor says, hey, we're going to change the portfolio to this, and you make that happen.
Exactly. They send us the tickers and then they go sell it. We pretty much do everything else. But that, because we can monetize all the fixed costs that way, we all, for our particular things, we don't have like a massive incentive to just sell it at any cost, which is why we have such a small footprint. And why obviously we've always been weird, but now we're in a structural way where we can continue to be weird, because I don't need to raise any more money, right? Like, I've already raised plenty of capital on the infrastructure side. So
it's Alpha Architect, the weird people.
Yeah, pretty much. we don't flow to the same beat as others with respect to how the products are produced.
So let's stay on this topic here, because there are a lot of advisors that listen to the show. And, you know, and actually sophisticated investors, because it's not limited to advisors. Anybody can create an ETF, right? I mean, it's not limited to somebody per se, although there may be some licensure issues in certain regards. But for both advisors and sophisticated investors, those groups in general, and maybe who want to build their own quant systems, right? Mm-hmm. So I have two questions about building ETFs and quant systems that can go hand in hand. First about maybe the pitfalls, because I've done a lot of work in technical analysis doing back testing, and I can't tell you how many times I get the most perfect, beautiful, back tested strategy. And the second you flick the switch, you know where I'm going with this, right?
Yeah. Damn, it doesn't work
anymore.
Yeah.
You could do everything you can to try to kill the strategy too ahead of time.
Yeah.
And when it's, you know, but this data snooping, there's survivorship bias on certain stocks, this look ahead bias.
Yeah.
So what of these things, the pitfalls in back testing, are you maybe looking at, and would you warn against most?
Sure. So so I did that for, I don't know, almost 20 years. I've written multiple books, multiple papers, got a PhD. This is all I did my whole life. And weirdly, you know, coming full circle on it, like, it boils down to, is there a first principle reason to believe this? And then the second question is, like, why would this continue to exist out of sample? Because just intuitively, if there's a $20 bill on the ground and it's easy to pick up, it's not going to exist, especially nowadays with supercomputers and AI. Like, that's just stupid talk, right?
Sure.
So usually what I like to see in a back test, because one of the biggest kind of principal reasons capital doesn't flow into a particular strategy is it either it makes you look really dumb, i.e. you can't raise a lot of capital, or it just has weird performance. Like, it's just an erratic strategy, right? And so my favorite chart to look at in any back test, doesn't really matter what the strategy is, I call it, would other asset managers or people actually do this as a product? Because that's what they're going to go sell it, raise capital, and, like, you know, move prices around. And so I always look at, like, I do 3, 5, and 10 year, but just look at the rolling 3 year performance versus a benchmark. Like, you know, if you're doing long only equity strategies, just call it the S&P 500, right? And so what you want to do is a 3 year period. That's kind of like the institutional mandate, you know, like most boards, they give you 3 years. And if you outperform, you get more money. If you underperform, you get fired. That's literally the mandate.
Right.
And so 3 years is a pretty good one, because that's actually in, like, a lot of, like, board of director and trustees mandates. And so most strategies, like, for example, value and momentum, they're the best ones. Like, it's not a secret that value and momentum over, like, hundreds of years and every data sample and every fucking guy or every person that's ever tested it or mucked with data can identify that, wow, these cheap stocks on average can outperform, you know, blah, blah, blah. But the real telling fact is when you start looking at like, well, what is the proportion of times over 3-year periods is the relative performance better than call it the S&P or whatever the benchmark is? Sure. You know, it might only be 60% or 50%. And then even over 5 years, maybe it's 70%. And over 10 years, maybe it's 80%. But that means that, and you love to see that, because if a strategy over 3 year is basically like a coin flip, mm-hmm. like that's terrible for business, right? Like we're not going to see tons of capital just arbitrage that away. Right. So any strategy that backtest really well, just like on an absolute, like I'm a personal investor, I just care about compounding sure. my money with right. low drawdowns. That's a total different way of thinking about the world than how capital, like outside capital, thinks about it, right? So backtested strategies that have weird activity relative to benchmarks, like trend, technical stuff are great examples, right? Like, hey, I'm going to go trend follow. And when the market sucks, I'm going to go flat. And then when it's on, you know, like that's a classic one that's been around for.
Theoretically, that makes sense. I've never understood it, by the way, because I've never understood yeah. when the in and out goes.
Yeah. And there's a million, you could do, you know, there's a thousand ways you can do it. They all get you to the same point. And generally speaking, a strategy like that works, quote unquote, over the long haul. However, if you compare your chart of like long only beta against trend follow beta, especially over the past 10 years, you're going to literally look like the biggest idiot on the planet. And right. you 100% will not be managing other people's money because
right.
almost certainly you've underperformed by magnitudes. Right. Yep. So, but that doesn't necessarily mean the strategy is bad, because you can look at every asset class that's ever been traded on the planet Earth at this point. And if you just do like a brain dead long only, like trend fault, like long-term trend rule, like you own it if it's trending, you go flat if you're not. Like literally, you get most of the return with half the drawdown if you have the horizon to think like that,
sure.
right?
Right.
And so those are great strategies. Where the back tests, you know, whether yeah, I can pick a million flavors of ice cream, but they're all the general same idea. As long as I know that the market for capital hates it, that's you know, it makes sense as a first principle idea, and then. Who would actually implement this as a business? If the answer is nobody with half a brain, you're probably onto something. But on the flip side of that, right. you got to deal with that, right? Right? And every day when you put on CNBC and you know you're down 5%, the market's up 20% again. You know now you got to deal with you know, your own demons of human yep. psychology. But that's also like ironically why those kind of strategies are probably more likely to work in the future.
You know, you mentioned something about retail a second ago and the individual yeah. investor. And I think it's fascinating, particularly today. When I say today, I mean like the last few weeks today.
Yeah.
Where mm-hmm. I have, you know, people that I know that are, let's call them risk averse, generally speaking, you know, sure. where they're like, oh, you know, I'm doing terrible. I'm like, what do you mean you're doing terrible? You're up 12% or whatever it is. You know what I mean? Not terrible comparatively, just terrible because yeah. they always think they're doing terrible no matter what happens.
Sure.
That concept. Yep. And meanwhile, then they send you an email and they're like, you know, or something, you know, oh, you know, should we be in the markets? I'm really worried about this and that and this. Okay. The next email is, what do you think about the SpaceX IPO? I'm like, what?
Exactly.
What are you talking about? Right.
I mean, the market's full of that stuff, man. FOMO, fear, greed, like all the things that people have been talking about since the beginning of time. It's no amount of education can derail monkey brain. It's just it's part of the deal. That's going back to your initial question. Why do I personally like computers and systems? Is because I understand that I also have monkey brain. And it's bad. And so the only way to get rid of my monkey brain is I have a system that I could design in like a calm, you know, moment when I'm feeling like relatively stable in life. Mm-hmm. And I just follow the system, period.
Right.
Even if I think the system may not be perfect, it's just better to have a system and a process that you follow with extreme discipline.
Yeah, because if your system works, I'm just going to pick a number and this yeah. is really not, but if your system works 75% of the time, I'm not talking about winning all the time, but 75%, yeah. there's some backups sure. here and there and all, but at least you got that because the human nature, obviously we've talked about this with, I could tell you how many behavioral finance sure. guys, right? You know, Dan and those guys, tons
yeah,
a couple
of
weeks
course.
Ago, we had Dr. Moore on. You know, the thing mm-hmm. is that we're all susceptible to the same thing. So anybody listening out there, two guys that have been, I've been in business a lot longer, but nonetheless, two guys managing money for a long period of time, have seen it all, back tested, worked with some of the best. And the fact of the matter is, don't think that Eugene Fama, by the way, didn't have some kind of weird FOMO and weird stuff and not thinking his stuff worked every once in a while too.
Of course.
You know,
he's also a human.
Yep.
And then the other thing that gets people is like, yeah, have a system and just know you're human. And, one trick that we always tell people, because I deal with a bunch of insanely rich folks, because we're kind of in the tax side of the world, is just, I call it like the fun bucket. It's kind of like, you go to the casino, bring $100, but not your credit card. Same thing. Like, okay, fine. You're a billionaire. Take $50 million. And go do your gambling with CNBC stock picks and all your back testing. But for the other 950, just do it in some very systematic process that, keep the fees down, keep the taxes down, keep the diversification high. Just, do all the things that you can control, because you can't control the market.
Right.
But, it's one way to psychologically, keep you having fun. But not blowing up the whole the whole kitty.
And also keeping you involved in the situation. I want to talk to you about commodities for a second. Managed commodities and managed futures maybe. So for years, I did something for client portfolios that I never liked. What I mean by that is we always had a position in commodities as part of a big asset allocation. Why? Because everything we've read, done, tested, reviewed, seen, it made sense. Right. Always have a little bit of that's my view. I'm not asking you if it's your view, but it's my view. But for years, I'm like, I hate this because I don't feel like I'm ever getting anywhere with these commodities. And it's just a drag, even in the bad years for equities and bonds. Maybe I'm like, okay. And I had an epiphany. And tell me what you think about this. The normal Bloomberg basket of commodities is, I'm just going to throw something out there, heavily weighted, we know, in energy. Right. So let's just say round number 50% energy, which may be natural gas and heating oil and crude, et cetera. There is a ceiling of how high prices can go, in my opinion. The higher the price, then that you get to such a level that it kind of cuts off people from buying.
Yeah, and or they find substitutes or what have you.
So you're gonna get it, and you get a floor. Things get low enough. We're going to buy for the strategic petroleum reserves, or somebody's going to start, instead of being an electric car, they're going to buy an F-350 or whatever, right? And I figured, well, if we're always in the same positions, how do I ever make money here? Especially if there's contango most of the time going on and I'm going to roll with this and lose and get clipped the whole time. 2 years ago, I'm like, I've had it. Now, I know at that point, if I was to get out of commodities, we're going to see a run. Okay.
Yeah.
But of course. I changed my parameter. I found an ETF style, which is basically a managed commodity program that looked to primarily invest in 14 different commodities that are backwardation primarily, and they can shift around on a continual basis. In other words, it was bottom line, without all the details, it was a trading process. So tell me about that, if you've ever studied that. Managed futures, managed commodities overlay versus static commodities, and how that blends in a portfolio.
Yeah, sure. We've been running a managed futures program for over a decade now. So I know everything about this at this point, or at least studied a lot of it. Don't know everything about it, obviously, or I'd have a private island. But essentially, yes, long only commodities, because the reason you mentioned are tough. They kind of give you inflation, but with 80% drawdowns, and that's not exactly fun.
Right.
But they kind of have, the two drivers would be like the carry component. So, contango versus backwardation, like all else equal, you'd prefer to have contango contracts. And I think the other big driver in that space is probably trend, right? If something's trending, great, own it. Otherwise, go flat or don't own it. So as long as you have a strategy that trades in future, like specific commodity futures or really any of those futures, if you include some carry in there, if you include some trend, that's probably on average, going to be better as far as a diversifier than just buy and hold the generic commodity basket.
Right, because the contango is going to kill you over time, but just holding. It's going to
exactly
1% every 3 months to thank you.
Yes.
Gone.
Yeah. And gold, like all the metals, all those contracts, if you just do like a generic, whatever, 6 months moving average or 12 month moving average over their whole histories, it's pretty obvious you don't want to buy and hold those things.
Right.
Like if they're trending, own them. Otherwise, don't. And if you want to get into the nuance of it, like you were saying, you know, focus on backwardation contango is also important at the margin. And to your point, there's ETFs and structures out there that do that, so you don't have to deal with it.
So here we are. We're at a 30-year treasury that is back to where it was in 07. We see the JGB, Japanese bond, 10-year, the highest since 1996. Obviously, that was a much more, I mean, the pain in 2022 in bonds, in my opinion, is nothing like what's going on in Japan. That's painful.
Yeah. Right? No, for sure. And like weirdly, like, cause again, all of our things that trade this are systems. It doesn't care. We primarily trade like trends, but I've just been seeing like this year, especially the managed future trade is basically short bonds, long commodities, long gold plus or minus. Mm-hmm. And that has been so hair raising where like for example, today it's, you know, getting destroyed and it's gotten like gone up a bunch, down a bunch, up a bunch. And it's fascinating. We're not just JGBs, but the entire 10-year, you know, sovereign complex has just gotten crushed. Today's obviously an exception to that rule.
But doesn't that tell you something, Wes? This idea that, you know, back in, you said you started back, basically, you studied things, but you started in 1999. And back in 1999, I could tell you that starting really for a few years before that, many years before that, this is like, well, this is the new thing, right? You know, we're going to need this. We got the Internet of Things. We got this. We got, you know, this was going to be something. And all these things that were happening was, no, it doesn't matter if they don't have money. Oh, it doesn't matter if we're valuing a particular website based on eyeballs, right? And I was like, are we counting one? Are we counting two? What are we doing with the eyeballs, right?
Exactly.
And you know, now we're in a situation where it's almost, again, now they tell me the same thing. It's different this time. Why is it different this time? Because a lot of money behind it. But then I'm like, what about the circular financing, the vendor financing, and all this other crap that's going on? And you know, the pricing that's going on. The other thing is that I guess I want to ask you about in today's environment, specifically in today's environment, the topic that has been troubling me is where we look at intermarket relationships. Correlations. And historically, as you mentioned about JGBs and golds and things like that with the trending, you know, you see things like, okay, bonds down, stocks up, or pick your particular intermarket relationship, dollar down, oil up, right? Or whatever.
Yeah.
And that seems to be a little bit broken right now in favor of, let's just watch the news and the Twitter feeds of right now, the Middle East newspapers, or, and I'm not saying just now, this is going on a little while, right? Where last week we saw, out of nowhere, quantum computers, interestingly, last week, the Barron's had a big article on quantum computing being a great thing. Quantum computing starts moving a little bit this week. And then on Thursday this week, we saw a $2 billion investment into the industry by the government of the United States and taking positions in the companies. 25-30% runs on these names. Are we in a period of long story to get to this point? Are we in a period that it's like macro news moving is more important than anything else?
You know, I don't know if you've had Bob Shiller on here. He has this great book called Animal Spirits. The basic thesis is that everything's behavioral. And when confidence is high and greed is high, all stories sell. We don't know who's swimming naked till the tide goes out, which is the Warren Buffett quote.
Yep.
Clearly, we don't know when this ends, but I think it's pretty obvious to anyone who's ever been around for longer than 5 minutes. We're in a high, strong animal spirit environment.
Right.
And people, for whatever reason, just have low risk aversion. Stories are hot. YOLO, FOMO, all these things are at extremes right now. And we're just in that type of a market. Like, and we all know that in the end, gravity has to matter. Like, why would you buy a stock in the end? Well, technically is it a real business that generates cash flow that I could actually eat? So like I can actually eat that cash flow someday, because otherwise it's just bullshit. At some point that has to matter in the long game, But as we all know, like in the short game, you know, these things can go crazy. Like, I mean, sure. Which is what's happening right now. And the problem is, you know, that's great. Like, we know it's overvalued. We know people are insane. We know risk aversion is way too low. How do you make money from that? The answer is that's really hard. Yeah. And it usually comes back to like, well, you can't, because that means you got to predict when the humans are going to change their confidence in their animal spirits. And nobody knows how to do that as far as I can tell. And so in the end, it doesn't really matter from like a strategic investment standpoint. You do all the boring shit, right? Stay diversified, lower your fees, lower your taxes, you know, own the commodity stuff, own your bonds, own everything. Because how can you predict this stuff? Even though we all know it's going to crash at some point, you know, if you don't know if it's going to be next week or 20 years from now, and it might be worse to be all cash. What if we have hyperinflation?
You know who also knows about this? The author of Animal Spirits wrote another book called Irrational Exuberance.
Yeah, exactly. Right? He has all the good ones.
right?
And he explains all these things. Yeah,
that was a great book. I enjoy that. Yeah. Let's switch gears now. Let's talk about one of the things that's happening is that a lot of people have, because of the nature of the markets over the last number of years, there is this idea that you get these positions that become concentrated in your portfolio.
Yeah.
And, you know, when they get to be a size that you're uncomfortable with, some people are like, well, what do I do with it? Well, you know, a lot of advice would be, well, just, you know, sell a little bit of it off here and there, maybe write some covered calls on it. There's a lot of things to do, but you're still susceptible to a lot of risk when the proportion of that asset becomes so large. You have done a great job of creating something. I'm going to let you take this from here, but this single stock concentration, tell me and kind of let's go through a little bit, because I think we have in another show we talked about this, but tell me about, you know, the 351 exchange and actually where it came from, because there's always been this, right? Goldman and these guys always had this kind of thing.
Yeah, so just stepping back right now in the marketplace, this is literally a white hot business right now. Not just us, but I'll walk you through kind of like all the different solutions out there. And we're all like the bell of the ball at the moment, because there's tons of people that have massive amounts of wealth in like a handful of things, but they can't do anything because they don't want to pay the tax.
Right.
Like why would you give up 50% or 20% or whatever it ends up being to get diversified, because you're also giving up a big chunk of your wealth. It'd be way better of how could I do this and keep kicking the taxes down the road, right? So basically, there's a million solutions out there, and this is a dangerous world because, you know, if you start talking to banks and structure products, like it can get very opaque, very expensive, and like any sort of benefit that someone might be talking about. Well, great. I might as well, after the fees and all the chaos you created, I might as well just held NVIDIA and paid the taxes, jerk.
Right.
But so for if you have super concentrated situation, like let's say you own SpaceX and that's all of your wealth,
right?
There's really only two solutions there. You can do what they call the exchange fund, not to be confused with the exchange traded fund. An exchange fund, it basically leans on some like partnership lots called Section 721, where essentially you can contribute your SpaceX into a pool, and then you kind of get access to all the other things in the pool. So, you know, whatever Warren Buffett puts in Berkshire, Michael Dell throws in Dell stock. So at least you can move from SpaceX to like this other stuff, right? And that's to your point, what you alluded to. That's what, you know, Goldman Sachs, Eaton Vance, and those guys have done for a long time. There's now newer solutions that are much cheaper and I think more efficient. Example would be like this firm called Cash Financial. But it's the same idea. If you have a concentrated position, you could dump it into these partnerships and you get diversified, but there's a catch. You got to hold it for 7 years.
Right.
And that sucks, right? Because now you're stuck in this thing. So yeah, you get diversified, but now you're also illiquid for 7 years, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But it's one solution. The other solution that I would say is the whitest hot flame out there is what they call long short tax loss harvesting, where it's, I'm sure your users are probably familiar with like tax loss harvesting, but essentially what they'll do is, let's say you have $1 million of, again, NVIDIA in your Schwab account.
Doesn't everybody, by the way?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, maybe at this point, everyone probably does if it keeps going up so high. Yep. But so the problem is you're like, geez, that NVIDIA's like, what if that goes down a lot? You know, that would stink. And so what they'll do is they'll use that and they'll put like a long short system around it. And they're it's kind of complicated. But basically what it's going to do is generate a whole bunch of losses that you can use to like start to slowly sell down that. And then you kind of transition your basis into like a diversified long portfolio. So that's another solution that people like. And then one of the solutions that we do specifically as a firm, but it's I would argue it's like one of the cleanest, but also has the most constraints, unfortunately, is what you alluded to, the 351. And so the 351 is when you can contribute property tax-free into a new ETF structure, which is awesome. Because now I just move like my NVIDIA and my other stuff or whatever it is into a low-cost, transparent, beautiful ETF. And there's no holding requirements, none of this stuff. However, the big catch on 351 is the only way to get the tax-free treatment is you have to contribute what they call a diversified portfolio. So if all you had is like NVIDIA, that ain't going to work because the requirements are no single stock can be over 25% of the contribution. And there's another rule called the 50% rule. So anyways, that's kind of your trio, right? You can go to the exchange fund route, which has a 7-year lock, but you get diversified. You can do the long, short tax loss harvesting, which is complicated, but not bad. But it also takes like 2, 3, 4 years, but at least it's liquid. You're not stuck in some structure. And then if you happen to have like a contrary position, but other stuff to kind of diversify away the concentration a little bit, i.e. you have 24% NVIDIA, not 100% of your money's in that, mm-hmm. you know, then you can contribute in these big 351 deals. And those are nice because now you get pulled in and you can basically kind of turn it into like S&P 500. So, but that's also way cheaper. There's no controls.
And by the way, just to be clear, so everybody knows, you're going to move this into there. You're going to keep your tax basis. If you have a 90% gain in NVIDIA, you're going to move. See, the problem is you're going to move this into this 351 fund. You're still going to have a 90% basis, yes. You know, in there.
Yes,
plus the difference
exactly.
is now you diversify your investments, so you don't have to worry about the volatility. That's really the big issue there.
Yes. Yes, the huge issue is the IRS, as you know, the only way you get rid of basis is you have to die.
Right.
Like that's the only way to get a step
up. That's not a preferable way of doing things.
Great. You're going to kill me and then you give me the benefit. Thanks, guys. Everything else, the best you can do is essentially deferral, which is your point. And the key thing here is you want to move away from concentrated risk to diversified risk because it's just... You maximize your chance to compound at a higher rate without the volatility drag.
Sure.
And then more importantly, if once you move to the next layer of sophistication, is it's way easier to leverage and borrow against a diversified portfolio.
Right.
So a lot of people are talking trash about it right now, and this is like a public debate, like political debate, but you know, a lot of like the Democrat type folks out there, you know, they say, oh, well, all these rich people, all they do is borrow against their positions. I'm like, well, yeah, of course. and it's even better if you can get to a diversified portfolio because your ability to borrow against like an S&P 500 sure. type asset is way better than trying to do what Elon does and borrow against like Tesla stock, right? So another benefit of getting more diversified is it also just kind of gives you better liquidity and access to your portfolio via like the lending markets.
Yep.
And you can kind of keep punting the tax down the road, but you get access to your capital again. So,
you know, there was, I don't know if you're around for this because I don't know what the date mm-hmm. was, but there was something way back when we used to use love short against the box. Do you remember the short against the box?
Yeah. They outlawed that, unfortunately.
That was great stuff.
Yeah. But that's generally speaking what people still do. But they do it in a financial engineered way, right? Like sure. you can't just go long Microsoft and then short Microsoft or use an option or whatever.
Right.
Like that's just too egregious. But you know, you might be long a basket of whatever 350 kind of market sure. cap stocks and short SPY, and it's not technically identical, and it's not going to be considered like a short against the box, but it's 95% risk hedged, right? And you still, you know, so there's a gradient there, and that's something that the IRS has really not attacked. Like, it's like, what does substantially identical mean? You talk, some guys are like, oh yeah, I go long the Russell 1000 and short SPY. I'm like, well, they're 99.99% correlated.
Right.
They're like, yeah, but they're not substantially identical. I'm like, well, no one's ever been busted on it yet.
But
a ton of people do that. And I don't, I'm not the IRS and it's a gray zone, but there, that's an area where people kind of gravitated from like the obvious ones they outlawed to like, well, let's do like ones that are 99% correlated, but different index.
I remember seriously, I don't think I was been emotional at this level for any kind of regulatory change ever. Since I was excited about the move from away from half steints and teenies. Remember those days?
Yeah.
That was a good thing. I was emotionally happy about that. Yeah. That of course some of my friends that were market makers were devastated. But that yeah. But the short against the box is one of those I was like, oh, so upset about. It was like, oh, this is such a great tool for temporary money in and out, And then back then there was also, a lot of collars still done.
Yep.
Where, you buy some options on top and the bottom, kind of call the whole position. So it doesn't move. But that's the interesting thing about that is it seems like that's great, but you're not moving it. You're walking up the down escalator.
Yeah. It's just, again, all those things, and those are still all around. There's a bunch of rules. They always try to constrain these things, which is great. That's more of a public policy thing. If it's up to me, I would just like, eliminate the tax because I want capital to have low cost of capital because I figure it'll spur like more innovation, more wealth, et cetera. But I'm obviously a Chicago school guy, like Milton Friedman type.
Right.
I got voted off island because apparently it's all communist these days. But but in my philosophy, I wouldn't have any of these stupid rules.
Right.
And we would just let people get as rich as humanly possible because that's just better for business formation and wealth creation, et cetera. But obviously we're not going to do that apparently. So we have all these rules, which is totally fine. And then, what people like, I feel like my job and other people's job is like, okay, you just tell me the rules and I'm just going to maximize as much efficiency from a tax perspective as humanly possible.
Yep.
And that's just how we're going to play this game.
I have one question I want to ask you in closing, and I don't know why I just thought of this. I just don't know where it just came from because I don't think I've ever really talked about it ever.
Yeah.
I've been doing this since 2007. I don't think I ever brought this up before. Structured products. The idea that you're going to buy the S&P with a 5-year period of time that if it's above this or below that and all this stuff. I see this stuff being sold, it's not being bought. It's being sold. Yeah. And every time I see it, it puts the hair on the back of my neck up a bit. And, first of all, the prospectus is this thick. It nobody understands. Even the guys that sell it don't really understand how you make money in it.
No, they just know that they get a 2% front end load or whatever.
Are these things going to ever go away? I mean, your analysis on this, I don't know how much you know about it, but it looks terrible.
Yes. So one of the things that actually the ETF market done, I don't know if you're familiar with the firm Innovator and like the whole buffer fund. But basically like they've basically took what was a classic kind of insurance heavy strategy where, the Boley Coley guys would give you that pitch. And then it's like, oh my God, the fees and like all this stuff is insane. And so they've moved all that into the ETF structure. And I wouldn't say it's necessarily like cheap and efficient like Vanguard, but it's way more tax efficient. It's way more transparent. And the fees have come way down in those products.
Right.
And that's why I think you've seen such growth in the buffer and the outcome ETF market. Because even though you can make arguments from like a quantitative finance perspective, like, well, that's dumb.
Yeah.
Why don't you just own a mix of like cash and stocks? You do your own delta hedging. It's way cheaper. But a lot of people, they just love outcome ETFs or like structures. We're like, oh, I get 10% upside, but no downs, whatever it is. And so at least I think as those products have moved into the ETF wrapper and they're way more accessible, it's putting, I think, a lot of competition on the insurance guys because they're like, oh, crap. Now there's actually a competitive alternative. So at least I got to make, they're still going to be opaque. They're still going to not be transparent. The prospectus will be a million pages long and you should run like hell when you see it. But at least at the margin, I think the competitive market is at least making it less onerous on people. Generally speaking,
that's good.
And I'm sure those
things were packed with fees. The only person I ever saw making money was the actual firm putting it out. They were doing the whole process to make money for themselves.
Yes. And that's still the case. It's still huge because they got captive distribution, But like I said, you know, competition is a you know what for people that are not selling something competitive.
Right.
And that the ETF market has been a very good force for good, at least from a consumer perspective of like forcing everyone in the financial service businesses to like deal with competition, which is awesome.
I love it.
And that's also why I like being in the ETF biz because I feel like we can just help continue to push that forward.
Yeah, so, great stuff. Wes Gray, Alpha Architects. Appreciate you coming on and being a good friend of the show and everything that you do for the industry. Great stuff. Thank you.
Likewise. Appreciate you having me.
All right, buddy. See ya.
Yeah, we'll see ya.
That's a smart guy. That's a really smart guy. And I really appreciate all the smart people that come on this show. And we have a lot of them. Great stuff. Got another one coming up next week with the head of analysis and stocks and markets and great stuff. Steve Sosnack from Interactive Brokers is coming on next week onto the show. So make sure to stay tuned for that because it's going to be a good one. I promise you that. Other than that, I want to wish you a great weekend. Hopefully all things are good. Welcome to June. Welcome to maybe they're not boring. We'll see what happens. Welcome to the next phase of this rally. Maybe is going to be underway as well. I'll see you soon. Thanks for joining me. This podcast is intended for informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized investment advice. Investing involves risk, including the possible loss of principal, and past performance is not indicative of future results. The views and opinions expressed are those of the host and any guests and may not necessarily reflect those of Horowitz & Company, Inc., an investment advisor registered with the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. Registration with the SEC does not imply a certain level of training or skill. Advisory services are only offered to a client or prospective clients where Horowitz & Company is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Any mention of third-party companies, products, or services is provided for informational purposes only and does not constitute an endorsement. Hypothetical scenarios or forward-looking statements are for illustrative purposes and should not be viewed as guarantees. Content is intended for U.S. residents only and may not be applicable in other jurisdictions. Listeners should consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions. Please visit our website for additional information, disclosures, as well as a copy of our Form CRS. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates or partners.